Nuclear theater. How do we get the complex issues of nuclear across to a population that has not been educated as to its horrors? Well, we can lecture, do TED Talks, launch a diatribe at the person stuck next to us in a grocery store line. But let's face it, that's not exactly a persuasive way to present our information. What we really want is to get the point across in a way that is powerful, motivational, and empathetic without scaring people off. So what can do this better than the arts? And who better than performers, singers, actors? Climate change activists have done this really well, but maybe they have a slightly easier sell for what they want people to know than those of us who focus on nukes. That point is confirmed when you hear from a veteran anti-nuclear activist who also works on climate change work, a singer-songwriter who uses performance to get the point across, and she tells you,
maybe it's more accessible for theater folks to do climate, but when they say, like, the greatest existential risk to humanity is climate change, I say, like, yeah, it is bad, but there ain't nothing worse than total global nuclear Armageddon annihilation murder of the biosphere. Like, nothing else matters after that.
It's not a competition to figure out which is the worst. They're both bad. But there is a matter of degree of difference. So when Linda Williams, the physics chanteuse, talks about communicating nuclear truths from the front lines of theater performance art, you get a new look at the challenges of communicating to others about that awful, dangerous, deadly seat that we all share.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat. It's da bomb.
Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat, the weekly international news magazine keeping you up to date on all things nuclear from a different perspective. We're a show for people who know nothing about nuclear who would like to know something, and people who know something about nuclear who would like to know just a little bit more. My name is Libby Halevi. I'm the producer and host, as well as a survivor of the nuclear accident at Three Mile Island from just 1 mile away. So I know what can happen when those nuclear so-called experts get it wrong. This week, we have a rollicking interview on nuclear theater with Linda Williams, a physicist and educator who also writes her own songs and sings as the physics chanteuse. And she tells us about her new show, Atomic Cabaret. It's a blend of story, science, satire, and songs that makes the nuclear debate accessible, if not a teensy bit of fun for the audiences to listen to. And it's intended for people with absolutely no background in the issues. She's currently touring Europe and is about to perform the show at the Edinburgh Arts Festival in August. And we revisit the Church Rock uranium tailings spill disaster of July 16, 1979. It took place on Navajo Nation land, contaminating the adjacent Puerco River, and still has not been cleaned up. We'll have interviews with three members of Navajo Nation who were frontline witnesses, survivors, and our activists. We will also have nuclear news from around the world, numbnuts of the week for outstanding nuclear boneheadedness, and more honest nuclear information than has appeared in the last week on Colbert and all the other U.S. late-night comedy shows combined. All of it coming up in just a few moments. Today is Tuesday, July 21st, 2025, and here is this week's nuclear news from a different perspective. Starting here in the U.S., where the New Mexico Environment Department, or NMED, has temporarily paused a plan to vent 30,000 curies of radioactive tritium into the air this summer. NMED, citing significant public interest, is requiring Los Alamos National Laboratory to perform 4 additional steps before proceeding, including an independent technical review, tribal consultations, public meetings, and a compliance audit. EnMed states, the historical gross mismanagement of these waste streams placed EnMed in an untenable situation. Your disregard of state laws and rules governing these wastes greatly exacerbated this situation and put New Mexicans, tribal communities, and our environment at risk. As a result, EnMed is separately starting a civil enforcement action pursuant to this matter. The Western Governors Association, a nonpartisan organization of all 22 governors from the western states of the United States, as well as the premiers in Western Canada, has approved a resolution outlining their views on the potential storage and transport of radioactive nuclear waste in their states. It read, "No consolidated facility for nuclear waste, whether interim or permanent, privately or federally owned and operated, shall be located within the geographic boundaries of a Western state or U.S. territory without the written consent of the current governor in whose state or territory the facility is to be located." Federal efforts to find a storage solution are about to enter a new phase while the Trump administration seeks to quickly build new reactors and usher in a so-called nuclear renaissance. The Department of Energy has, in recent years, been using what it is now calling a collaboration-based siting process to eventually identify a place willing to store spent fuel from power plants. In the early phases of this process, the DOE has awarded millions of dollars in grant funds with the goal of starting conversations about nuclear waste storage around the country. Small-town communities in rural areas with limited opportunities for financial growth, including in Northwest Colorado, have entered into preliminary conversations about partnering with the federal government on a nuclear waste storage facility. Applications will be reviewed in early 2026, and successful applicants will receive, quote, federal funding and technical assistance to help them work through community-led projects that will help inform this decision process. In other words, they'll get money and propaganda talking points with no opposition that points out the long-term pitfalls of having a nuclear dump in your community. The U.S. Federal Nuclear Regulatory Commission was originally established to monitor the safety of all nuclear operating facilities. Thus, it is concerning that recently they changed their mission statement, adding the word enabling so that it now reads, "The NRC protects public health and safety and advances the nation's common defense and security by enabling the safe and secure use and deployment of civilian nuclear energy technologies and radioactive materials." That puts it in the position of helping the nuclear industry get its approvals and its licenses, rather than standing up to them and demanding full protection from its operation over people and the environment. We will have someone on the show in the coming weeks who can speak with much more specificity about exactly what's wrong with this wording change and what it implies. Also at the NRC, it has accelerated the review process for TerraPower's Natrium nuclear reactor intended to be built in Kemmerer, Wyoming. This decision to fast-track the review process for Bill Gates' TerraPower reactor, the NRC has shaved more than 6 months off the process of review from August 2026 to the end of 2025. Note that, as we say regularly on this program, when it comes to the development of nuclear anything, the two words you don't want to hear are faster and cheaper. We'll have several links up to really great longer articles, one by Avery Lovins from Beyond Nuclear International. "Global nuclear power in a good year adds only as much net capacity as renewables add every 2 days." And that nuclear power is a parasite on AI's credibility. A companion article from the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists is headlined, "The first U.S. atomic rush was a bust. Will Trump's big nuclear for AI plans fare any better?" An article on nuclear power's hot streak by the esteemed Carl Grossman and Harvey Wasserman, about what they label the big lie that atomic reactors are an answer to global warming when in fact they are significant sources of heat. This one is a real eye-opener. Over to Japan, where that country seems to be in a rush to build its first new nuclear reactor since the Fukushima triple meltdown in 2011. Kansai Electric Power Company, otherwise known as KEPCO, will begin the process of building a new reactor at its Mahama nuclear power plant in Fukui Prefecture. They're calling it a next-generation reactor, which is latest nuke speak for small modular nuclear reactors, no design for which has ever been built, let alone tested, let alone approved. The government announced a new basic energy plan last February, clarifying the policy of making maximum use of nuclear plants and outlining plans to work on the development and installation of, again, what they call next-generation reactors, quote, that are safer than conventional ones. But how do you know that they're safer if you haven't built one and operated it over an extended period of time? And now...
Nuclear hot seat, none that's out of week.
It seems the government of Japan and Tokyo Electric Power Company will go to any lengths to convince the people of that country that there is absolutely nothing wrong with radioactive soil from Fukushima. No danger at all. And that's why this past week, dozens of bags of radioactive soil collected from near the stricken Fukushima nuclear plant were delivered to Prime Minister Shigeru Ishiba's office in an effort to show that it is safe for reuse. They are infusing media with the standard false equivalency that the topsoil, which was scraped off of Fukushima and put into bags to be stored, contains such a low level of radiation that it's the equivalent to or less than one X-ray per year for people who directly stand on or work with it. This according to the Environment Ministry. What's wrong with that? An X-ray is a voluntary exposure to radiation for medical purposes that lasts a mere fraction of a second and is over. Everyone around it is shielded, and everything on the person who is being X-rayed is shielded, except for the area that is being checked. This exposure has no cutoff time. Anyone in contact with it will be exposed continuously, and it is known that radiation accumulates in the body, so that even exposure to so-called low levels of radiation can have devastating impacts over time on a person's health. But while these stories led with the statement that the soil was delivered to the Prime Minister's office, it was actually deposited in the front yard of the Prime Minister's office and will be used in flower beds, where a layer of ordinary soil of around 20 centimeters or 8 inches deep will sit on top of the Fukushima soil. Flower beds? When they're watered, radioactive materials will filter through and drip down deeper into the soil to be taken up by other plants. I've not yet determined whether 10 inches of soil is an adequate shield for radiation exposure, but I suspect not. And it's all optics. Another nuclear stunt to try and trick people into thinking that radiation is safe when its dangers are the ugliest and most frenetically concealed aspect of nuclear dangers. So to the jokesters who thought up this stunt, as well as Prime Minister Ishiba, whose ruling coalition lost its majority in the upper house elections last Sunday and is under pressure to resign, meaning he will be leaving this as a legacy to whoever comes after him, you are this week's
Nuclear Hot Seat, none that's out of week.
At an assembly of Nobel laureates, nuclear experts, and diplomats gathered at the University of Chicago to mark the 80th anniversary of the first nuclear explosion at the Trinity site in New Mexico, the group issued a warning. Their statement read in part that humanity is, quote, heading in the wrong direction on the one threat that could, quote, end civilization in an afternoon. They went on to say, without clear and sustained efforts from world leaders to prevent nuclear war, there can be no doubt that our luck will finally run out. Heed our warnings. And they pushed for diplomacy to prevent nuclear war as the only thing that possibly can. At the United Nations, Secretary General Antonio Guterres announced the appointment of an independent scientific panel of experts tasked with examining the physical effects and societal consequences of a nuclear war on a local, regional, and planetary scale in the days, weeks, and decades following a nuclear war. Based on a UN resolution entitled Nuclear War Effects and Scientific Research, it further tasks the panel with studying the climatic, environmental, and radiological effects of such a war and the impact on public health, global socioeconomic systems, agriculture and ecosystems, and track both the immediate and long-term effects of such a war. As for those impacts, a new report on the United States nuclear weapons testing legacy in the Marshall Islands highlights the lack of studies into important health concerns voiced by the Marshallese for decades, and that lack of studies makes it impossible to have a clear understanding of the impacts of the 67 nuclear weapons tests. The report, entitled The Legacy of U.S. Nuclear Testing in the Marshall Islands, was written by Dr. Arjun Makhijani of the Institute for Energy and Environmental Research and funded by Greenpeace Germany. Makhijani writes that the United States had concluded in 1948, after just three tests, that the Marshall Islands was not a suitable site for atomic experiments because it did not meet the required meteorological criteria. Yet, testing went on, and the lack of systemic scientific attention to the accounts of many Marshallese of severe malformations and other adverse pregnancy outcomes was not taken into account, despite the documented fallout throughout the country and the fact that the potential for fallout to cause major birth defects has been known since the 1950s. We'll link to this one, too. In Australia, samples of marine sediment taken from the locations of three 1950s British government nuclear bomb tests off the coast of Western Australia have revealed plutonium levels up to 4,500 times higher than the rest of the coastline. The British government performed three nuclear tests on the uninhabited remote islands, about 80 kilometers or 50 miles off the Western Australia coastline between October 1952 and June 1956. Because plutonium is entirely human-made, it could only be released by nuclear bombs, nuclear facilities, or nuclear accidents. The contamination will persist for many thousands of years, and while the islands are not inhabited, they are visited by recreational fishing boats, which raises the question, has anybody bothered to test the fish? Now here's the first of this week's features. Last week, we noted the dual nuclear nightmare anniversaries of July 16, focusing on the Trinity atomic test blast 80 years ago. Beyond a brief mention, there was no time on that show to go into the second July 16 anniversary, 1979's Church Rock uranium tailings spill on Navajo Nation land. It happened only 4 months after the Three Mile Island nuclear accident, but was basically ignored by U.S. media, a condition that continues to this day. In 2019, I traveled to Navajo Nation to report on Church Rock and the ongoing contamination from that accident, as well as the abandoned uranium mines. My trip was timed so I could attend the 40th anniversary commemoration of the Church Rock disaster. While there, I spoke with many who had grown up with these dangers and were still suffering from what it did to them, their families, their livestock, the land, and the water. Here, I share with you three brief interviews with members of Navajo Nation, uranium miner Larry J. King, Edith Hutt, and Teresita Kiana, all of whom were directly impacted by the uranium tailing spill disaster and the legacy of unremediated uranium mines literally in their own backyards. This is from a full-length special on church rock that was originally presented in two parts on Nuclear Hot Seat number 421 and 423 from July 2019. First, we hear from former uranium miner Larry J. King. He worked on site at the United Nuclear Corporation mine on the day the tailings pond spill happened.
What did the company tell you about the danger of being around uranium and any kind of safety practices that you should follow?
Nothing. There was absolutely no forewarnings of what could come, how your health could be affected by being exposed to uranium. Nothing. The only time we had any kind of safety training was at the beginning of the employment. Just told us these are your safety apparatus, your safety boots, your slickers, more like a raincoat and pants, and your safety helmets with the underground lamp, gloves. That was it. So the only thing that I had to wear every day was the safety boots and the hard hat and the lamp. Nothing else. Just about everybody was like that because it wasn't mandatory. They didn't stress that you gotta wear this all the time. Respirators, nope, it was not.
Were there any radiation monitors around or Geiger counters?
They had a little object that they stuck inside our helmets, a dosimeter, and all I remember is it was placed in there, and I don't ever recall being called in to get their recording or get it scanned, nothing. And we were not told how much exposures we had, nothing at all.
We then discussed the tailings pond and the early warning that was not heeded that something was terribly wrong.
We drove over to the mill site to the dam where the tailings dam were. And on the southern end of the tailings pond, I saw a lot of people there walking back and forth. We drove up to where they were. And right away, I noticed large cracks in the tailings dam. Large enough to put your hand in there, but you can't see the bottom of it. It just went down. It was black, so I couldn't see the bottom. There were several of them. I just wandered around there, and my supervisor was at a distance talking to other mining officials. I'm sure they were the top brass for the company. I don't know if they were also from the New Mexico Environment Department. I don't know. But they were there for a long time. I don't know what their conversation was. Then after that, we just got back in the vehicle. We just drove back to the mine site. The dam was still holding.
So UNC knew that they had a problem and did nothing about it. At some point after that, Larry was not certain if it was days or as much as 2 weeks. Everything changed.
It was until after 8 o'clock, I don't know, about 9 o'clock, by the time all the personnel had switched over from the graveyard shift to the day shift. That's when I started hearing people talking among themselves that, did you see the dam? Did you see the dam? So I didn't know what they were talking about. Eventually, I heard that the dam had broke. There was a huge gap in the dam. So when I got off after 2 o'clock and I was headed home and I looked in that direction, and it's the exact same spot where I seen those huge cracks days before.
Did they tell you anything about it?
No. Nobody told us anything. I didn't really pay attention to what was going on at that time because I don't know if the word is naive. I was a young kid at the time, just 23 years old, so I didn't really pay attention at all. I should have, but I didn't.
However, Larry did have insights into how UNC got away with their unsafe practices.
In the days that followed, was there any change in the way the company acted or the way they treated the miners, or was there any kind of testing?
No, it was just business as usual every day. I know there were safety policies in place because OSHA was there at the time. Every so often, the OSHA inspectors come in. And the way we knew it was days prior to them coming in, that's when they started barricading tunnels where they were not active to close off the radiation. Vent bags with fans were extended up to about 20 feet to where the miners are working. So they fixed up everything.
They were staging it.
Yeah, they were staging it to make it look like the mine was in compliance with OSHA policies. So we knew the inspectors were coming in. And sure enough, the next day they'd be wandering around. And I'm sure the mine got a passing grade. And within days, all those barricades that were put up, they came down.
Former uranium miner Larry J. King. Edith Hood grew up in the Redwater Pond Road community on land which had her living between two abandoned uranium mines and just down the road from the 1979 tailings pond spill. Edith worked at a different mine than the United Nuclear Corporation, UNC, mine that had the accident, but faced all of the same dangers.
I didn't know about it till about 2 days later. It had happened. I heard reports that there's already the dam breach happening, but nobody did anything about it. I don't think anybody had an idea what to do or how it would affect people maybe down the way, especially for us, you know. Never, even me having to work in the mines, did I ever hear the word unsafe. Something's going to happen to you, especially, you know, physically, your body.
She didn't learn about the dangers until more than 20 years after the spill.
Probably in 2003, the mines had been closed for like 20 years. And I guess most of our talking was about the mine sites where they were left as is, not fenced in, not covered, no signs, nothing.
When the first testing was done around Redwater Pond Road community, the results were shocking. What did they find?
Hot spots. This is along the highway. And then somewhere they got into the ditches. As they kept going up through here, up into our little arroyo that is right in the center of the community, they showed hot spots. Very hot. They never said it was unsafe. Everything's clean. And they left after that time. That's when I was diagnosed with lymphoma.
Edith Hood. Teresita Kiana has lived her entire life in the Redwater Pond Road community. She was not even born when the Church Rock uranium spill happened. But that did not stop her exposure to uranium mining waste by what was deposited by the spill and the two surrounding mines. I asked her what she had been told about the accident while growing up.
Nothing. I wasn't aware of it. I didn't know much about it. As a child, I played in these abandoned uranium mills and mining areas, and my grandmother owned sheep, so sometimes I had to herd the sheep or get the sheep when they got onto the mining areas, the milling areas, and there was no fencing up, and so I just walked right in, got our sheep, came back through, got them back at home. Nobody ever said, you don't go in these areas, that's dangerous, nothing like that.
The first visible signs of impact from the spill came from the livestock.
A sheep that had been butchered years ago, and the entire insides, the internal organs, all are tinted yellowish, and that's due to the radiation.
The problems continue to this day.
PA, they won't allow us to plant crops because we can't eat them, can't keep our livestock. The reason why we have our livestock is because we utilize them as an economic way and also a cultural way. We don't just keep just to have, as white folks like to have horses and cows just to be there. We like to utilize everything. So our sheep, we eat it. The wool, we use it to create rugs.
Through the years, the impact on her family's health has been extensive and devastating.
We have had cancers, respiratory illnesses. We've had some people pass away from respiratory illnesses, pulmonary fibrosis, COPD. So basically, these people who have passed away from respiratory illnesses, we had to watch them suffocate to death. And it was very traumatic, and it's something that we have to live and endure just because it's almost a norm here because of the radiation and the impact that the dust and the water and the land has done to our bodies, done to our community. you know, you hate to say it, but it's kind of just like environmental racism, where our community is somewhat seen as expendable. You hate to say it, and you hate to feel that way, but that's how it feels for our entire community, that we are the expendable people, because it took so long for anybody to acknowledge what was going on here.
Teresita Kiana. We will have a link up to both Church Rock anniversary programs from 2019 on the website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 734. We'll have our other feature in just a moment, but first, the Trinity Test, Church Rock, Hiroshima, Nagasaki, uranium mining, radioactive waste dumps, Nevada test site, Chernobyl, Fukushima, Three Mile Island, and too many more. The list of nuclear dangers and disasters is as endless as the life-destroying impact of the plutonium that they create, and it has a radioactive half-life of 24,000 years, causing everything from cancer to birth defects and much more. Every week, there are stories of how this industry has been playing loose and fast with our health, our safety, and the future. There are also stories of how brave activists around the world are fighting back, and how any one of us can take action to try and stop atomic madness. That's why Nuclear Hot Seat is here, to help you know what's going on in the nuclear world and what you can do about it. We get into nuclear stories with facts, continuity, and context, as well as a healthy dose of skepticism, and definitely with a much deeper and nuanced telling than you would ever expect on mainstream media. We get behind the scenes, under the skin, and into the heart of nuclear matters every week, with fresh information, an unrelenting perspective, and even, whenever possible, humor. That's why now would be the time to support us with a donation. Right now, go to nuclearhotseat.com and click on the red donate button. If you have Zelle, you can send money directly to info@nuclearhotseat.com. Nuclear Hot Seat is a 501c3 nonprofit organization, which means that anything you donate is tax deductible. And any amount helps, none too little, none too large. So don't wait. Go now to nuclearhotseat.com to donate. And whatever you can do to help us keep going, know that I am deeply grateful that you are listening and that you care. Now here's this week's second feature. Linda Williams bills herself as the physics chanteuse. She is a physician and educator who writes and performs songs about her favorite subject, physics. This science entertainer has performed all over the physics conference circuit. Who knew there was such a thing? And that's where she presents customized cabaret shows of songs and repartee to fit with each group's specialty. Williams has also taken her material into U.S. schools to get pupils turned on to science. Now, she is touring her cabaret-style musical act around Europe in her latest show, Atomic Cabaret. It combines science, story, satire, and song that explores the existential risks of the nuclear age, with video projections of scientific visualizations, archival footage, and original music. Atomic Cabaret offers a powerful and immersive experience that brings complex scientific ideas to life in an accessible way while addressing the urgent need for nuclear disarmament and global peace. There's an audience sing-along as well. Each performance on her 2025 European tour is a benefit for local chapters of the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament or community peace organizations. Now halfway through her tour, the show opens at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival in Scotland for a 9-performance run beginning on August 1st. To find out more, I spoke with Linda Williams on July 19, 2025. Linda Williams, it is so great to have you here with us on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Thank you so much for inviting me, Libby. It's absolutely fantastic to be here.
What is the physics chanteuse?
The physics chanteuse, well, I'm a cabaret singer and I sing about science and I sing about physics And this time I'm singing about nuclear weapons, the physics of atomic weapons.
Where's the material come from?
Research. So the material is primarily coming from my entire life of being an anti-nuclear activist. And I'm pulling from the content that I used when I was a college professor, how I would slip in curriculum for my pre-meds about the realities of radiation and nuclear empire. So I'm kind of pulling from that, but I also wrote some original songs just for this show and continue to work while I'm on the road at, you know, perfecting the show and writing new content.
Give us an idea of one of the songs.
One of the songs that I love so much is on depleted uranium, because a lot of people do not know about how depleted uranium is produced, how it is used in warfare, that it's actually a nuclear weapon, even though it doesn't detonate and blow up, it is radioactive, and how important it is to include depleted uranium weapons and uranium weapons into our peace movement and the abolition of nuclear weapons. So every time I do a show, people are like, I had no idea about depleted uranium, including peace activists. So that's one song. And the whole chorus is depleted uranium isn't depleted. It's full of radioactive uranium. And so, because it's such a misnomer, it's like impotent, like non-radioactive, it's such a lie. So I love that song because it blows everyone's mind.
I love the use of the term blows people's minds, because with an atomic show, what else would you want to do?
Exactly.
So let's roll this back a little bit. What is your background when it comes to physics?
I have a bachelor's in mathematics, applied mathematics, and a master's in physics. I have been in several programs, but for one reason or another, I didn't complete my PhD, but I've done all the work. My goal was always to do science communication, science theater, science film about environmental issues like nuclear weapons and uranium mining and et cetera. But I ended up having to teach to take care of my family. So I was a college professor at a community college in California for 20 years, which I recently retired from. And during all that time, I did shows for scientists. I'd be hired for a conference like the American Geological Union, and I would write original songs and repartee on climate issues for scientists or for the general public. I'd spent 20 years doing that for dozens of scientists and whatnot. So this is a good shift for me because I'm focusing on nuclear weapons, which I've always been passionate about and is why I got into physics in the first place, was to be a more informed abolitionist.
Why this show and why now?
Well, it's the 80th anniversary of the U.S. bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki and Trinity. So I just felt like it was time to put together all the work I've been doing over the years and commemorate that. And I've always wanted to go to Edinburgh Fringe Festival in Scotland. And this was the show that I had to do. And so I decided, since I was going to do that, I may as well tour through Europe. And now I'm in Belgium. I'm doing about 10 shows before I get to Edinburgh. And then I'll do Glasgow and Dundee Fringe after that. So it turned into kind of this whirlwind tour, which has been really interesting, trying to bring this information to people, which always blows their mind because they just didn't know about it.
This is really the definition of an extreme out-of-town tryout that you've just done with several performances leading up to Edinburgh. Theater people know about Edinburgh, but there are people who don't know about theater who are listening to this. And I just want to explain that the Edinburgh Festival is the world's largest arts festival. This year, it's running from the 1st to the 25th of August. And during that time, it will present more than 1,700 shows in various genres. 24 hours a day, you can catch theater, music, performance, clowning, circus, whatever it is, people come together and take over Edinburgh, and it is wild. So with you going into Edinburgh now, what are you doing to stand out and be separate from those other 1,699 shows?
I mean, I thought it was 4,000 shows, but I have posters, I'm flyering, I'm connecting with Scottish CND, which is the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament. I'm trying to connect with activists, but mostly I want to reach a non-activist group of people because they're the ones that I want to activate. My dream would be to have other performers see my show and get activated about doing work on this subject, right? I mean, I'm an elder. I'm going to retire soon. So hopefully someone, young folks, will take the baton or the, and carry on with the relay of doing performance related to nuclear weapons. There's plenty of performance here at Edinburgh on climate. So I'm also doing a showcase on climate because I have so many songs on the greenhouse effect and climate science and nuclear winter that I can just put together to do a little show there. So there's a lot of climate and environmental shows, but I might be the only one doing nuclear weapons. I search under nuclear weapons and then nothing comes up but me. Standing out is a challenge. So the whole thing about trying to get thousands of people to come to your show is flyering. So I have this little compact video projector and I'm going to just be out at night with the projecting video bombs going off and then handing out my flyer. I mean, you know, it's a challenge to figure out how to get an audience for sure with all the competition, all the great shows that are there.
You've already done a number of performances of these. How has the audience reaction been?
After the show, I always say, stick around for a Q&A, and no one leaves. Everyone just sits there. No matter what show it is, everyone just stays, and they don't want to leave, and they want to ask questions. Unfortunately, with the Edinburgh Fringe, you have to get in and get out because there's another show coming in. So I won't be able to do that there. But the thing is just the interest. I think the show draws folks in who tend to be a little bit more educated and aware. So they might already be concerned about the issue, but they learn things they didn't know. Another song I wrote is Alpha Beta Gamma, sung to the tune of Do Re Mi. And I get the whole audience singing about Alpha Beta Gamma. You know, so there's fun elements. But the other night, I did have a woman leave and crying in tears. And actually, it's the appropriate response, right? She was like, I can't take it anymore. It's too much. And she ran out, and I was able to talk to her later and have a deep conversation because it is traumatic to realize that we have the capacity to murder the biosphere many times over and nobody's doing anything about it from governments.
Given the heaviness of the topic and the seriousness of it, it sounds like you managed to infuse fun into the show.
I'm not so sure about fun. I mean, I try. Sing along is always fun. But then it kind of turns and goes into the facts. And, you know, once you talk about Trinity, and I appropriate material to what I do. And so there's a video projection behind me. And I have the voices of the victims of Trinity speaking over music. I have victims of Hiroshima and Nagasaki speaking. And it turns a dark corner because it's hard not to. But then I have to like lighten it up. So then I make some satirical songs that are funny just in their darkness. And then now I'm working on penis missile envy jokes that try to lighten it up a la Helen Caldicott. So, you know, because I need to, especially Edinburgh's all comedy. There's no comedy in my show. So now I'm working on jokes. I mean, this is a work in progress. This has evolved already. It is a completely different show than the world premiere in Belfast a month ago. That's the beauty of cabaret, because I got reviewed in Belfast. I had a very lovely review, but he did say, you know, it's a stretch to call it cabaret because it's more like a TED Talk with some great songs.
That is a great quote line, a TED Talk with songs.
Well, the thing is, he also called it agit-pop theater, which goes back to the original history of political theater. So that was a really good quote as well. But, you know, I'm trying to figure out I'm doing so much explaining and exposition that the drama kind of gets lost. So, and actually, I'm not a dramatic actress. I'm a physics teacher and a singer. So I do some exposition, then I sing a song. To do the lead up to depleted uranium, I have to go all through enrichment, gaseous diffusion versus centrifuge, and then the history of the U.S. going to war over centrifuges. I mean, it takes a while to get to the song because there's so much exposition. But I don't want to let go of that. Like, I don't want to turn this into a Nina Bausch dance performance. I could do it if I want to do like a dance interpretive nuclear weapons. But what I really want to do is activate people. Luckily, people really like the songs. People compliment me on singing well. And so that's a thrill. And afterwards, like I said, people stay and they want to talk and we go to the pub and because I'm in the UK and we always go to the pub and we're drinking and talking afterwards for hours. That's exciting. So even if there's only five people in the audience and they all want to stay and talk and they're not running out crying, my mission accomplished.
Scotland is in a unique position because the country itself is against all things nuclear. But because they're part of the UK, which is the over government for them, they have no say in what goes on in their territory. And there are a lot of people who I have met through the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, ICAN, who are from Scotland and are really ticked off. And it sounds like this presentation, this cabaret of yours, could be perhaps an organizing or an outreach program for them to take advantage of while you're there. What connection have you had with any of the anti-nuclear groups in Scotland or elsewhere?
Well, okay, so I did several shows in Yorkshire, which is like Leeds. Menwith Hill is there. That's a US base that's in Yorkshire in England. And that is the largest spy base in the world. And so every year on July 4th, they have an Independence from America Day, and I performed there. And that was supported by the Accountability of American Bases organization in Yorkshire, CND. And that was a fabulous show. I mean, I had like 80 activists. That's the best audience, that just cheering during the show. So that was lovely. Scottish CND is help promoting. I'm currently in Belgium and I'm being supported by Vrede, Vrede, which means peace in Dutch. They have an organization here and they're helping promote me. So here in Belgium, it's the Ghent Festival and there's like 10,000 people here and shows for 2 weeks. It's like an insane, it's even more crazy. I don't know if it's more crazy than Edinburgh because I've never been to Edinburgh, but there's just hundreds of shows going on. And so hopefully I'll have a turnout. And I'm trying to shift the show towards NATO because Belgium has US nuclear weapons. They have B-61s as part of the NATO SHARE program. So they have nuclear weapons here in Belgium, in the UK, and in Scotland. I'm focusing on the fast lane where the Vanguard nuclear submarine is. They have the Trident missiles, and they're going to spend about $70 billion upgrading to the Dreadnought, but I like to call it Dread-a-lot. It's the Dreadnought submarine, because we have a submarine arms race going on right now. The US is also spending billions on upgrading their submarine nuclear weapon arsenals. So I try wherever I go to kind of focus. Like when I was in the UK, I focus on, when I was in London and England, I focus on US bases and the UK's responsibility with nuclear weapons. That way I can kind of shift the show to wherever I go to try to address the needs of the communities that are there that they may not even know about.
How many shows will you be doing in Edinburgh?
I'm doing 9 shows in Edinburgh of Atomic Cabaret. Then I dash over to Glasgow and I do 1 show there and I want to go visit Fastlane. And then I do 1 climate showcase, which will be climate songs. And I'll also do Nuclear Winter because that was done, with Alan Robach and Brian Toon, the climate scientists who are doing that research about nuclear winter. And then I go to Dundee Fringe for 1 show. And I think I'm going to go home after that. I was thinking of going to Italy and maybe Berlin, but I kind of miss Hawaii. And I want to come back for the International Uranium Film Festival that's going to be held in Window Rock, New Mexico. Hopefully, do the show there and I can focus on the impact of uranium mining and testing and downwinders in the show.
I believe it's November 13 and 14. So, with all of this in front of you, what do you want the show to accomplish?
I would love the show to accomplish getting press so I can get the word out, which I've gotten some press so far, so that's nice. And then reaching people to activate them to be abolitionists, to demand from their governments that they eliminate nuclear weapons from the world and the existential threat of murdering the planet. I mean, that's the goal, is to save the planet. I'm also honing my skills. I've gotten much better at producing, and I kind of think that I want to produce my own fringe festival for political theater in Hawaii, because I'm an elder and I think, like, I can't travel so much. Maybe after a few years, I'll settle down and host a theater works on political issues such as nuclear weapons, climate change, social justice. So I took 20 years off. I mean, I didn't do a lot of performing for a while because I had to take care of family. I had some family members who were ill and I took care of them and I stopped performing. So this is the first big show I've done in a decade. So I'm just kind of getting my mojo going and my performance chops and my production chops up again. Next year's the anniversary of Chernobyl. So I could do a whole show on Chernobyl. I think it's the 40th anniversary of Chernobyl next year.
I believe so.
I would love to shred nuclear power. Yeah, there's a lot to be done. And again, I hope to be more of an example. Already, I met one young woman who's going to be in Edinburgh, and she wants to do work, performance work, and theater on nuclear issues. So I think the more we can get nuclear weapons and nuclear power and the horror of it into the zeitgeist, the collective consciousness, through theater, through art, it's really exciting to see artists such as yourself, who are doing new work on nuclear issues, trying to bring this subject into the consciousness of regular people, if you like, through theater, through the arts, which also has an element of joy, right? So I think it would be lovely if we started a group of artists, theater, musicians who are working on these topics. We could have like a guild or something, like the Nuclear Arts Guild. That would be the nag. And let's get us all together. We're gonna have a conference and a work on how to express. It's a challenge. So how do you do the exposition? I know you know this. How do you do the exposition to explain a very fundamentally complicated subject to a mostly scientifically illiterate audience on average? So that you can talk about the issues. That's a challenge. Even how to do this kind of art is challenging and needs to have more collaboration and some funding so that we can make new works.
There are certainly a number of artists and musicians who have been in contact with me through the years. And at whatever point you're ready to pull that together and have a contact point, either an email or a website, anything like that, I will put out the word so that we can get together. Because you're right, we're stronger with each other
Yeah.
and with the networking and mutual support than we are as individuals.
Well, think about it. You have the International Uranium Film Festival, which brings filmmakers together, right? So there's already that tremendously powerful venue. But what is there for theater in terms of nuclear issues? I don't know anything. There's a lot of climate theater groups. So there's a lot more people doing climate science. Like at Edinburgh, I'm in a group of like 20 artists doing climate shows. So maybe it's more accessible for theater folks to do climate. But when they say like the greatest existential risk to humanity is climate change, I say like, yeah, it is bad, but there ain't nothing worse than total global nuclear Armageddon, annihilation, murder of the biosphere. Like that is the jig. Nothing else matters after that. So I, not to be competitive about whose issue is more horrible, but maybe it's just too challenging to touch it, the subject, because it's hard. It's a hard subject to tackle, and I appreciate you so much for dealing with it every ding dong day with Nuclear Hot Seat. You do tremendous work. I'm just so in awe of you.
Well, thank you for that. I do take Thursdays and Saturdays off from nuclear, except if I have an interview with someone like you, where it's
Sorry.
the only time we can do it. Will there be a U.S. tour, an opportunity for those of us here in the lower 48 to actually see your show?
I'm hoping to bring it to other fringe festivals. There's a fringe festival in Hawaii, there's one in LA I could possibly do in the next year. I'm also looking for venues in San Francisco. And then I would record it. So my goal would be to record a full version and put it online and give it away.
Well, you and I will talk off this interview and do a little bit of strategizing with each other and sharing of contacts. Is there anything that you haven't had a chance to say that you would like to say now?
I know you always ask that of people. What do you say? Everything is made of atoms. We are made of atoms. The universe is made of atoms. Life is an atomic cabaret. But we just need to leave the uranium in the ground and get rid of all the nuclear weapons and stop fission from ever happening again, because it's unnatural and the risk is too great. And then besides that, I just want to say, folks, make some theater and joy, because that's the only solution to this madness.
If people wish to follow your work or possibly get in contact with you, what's the best way for them to do so?
Well, they can head right to my website, which is atomiccabaret.com, one word, and you can learn all about my tour there. You can contact me on that website. You can also go to my YouTube channel. I have all of my songs from the show on YouTube, and that's Linda Lovon. That's LyndaLovon. That's the particle of love, the Lovon, so it's Linda Lovon. In fact, I'm lyndalovon@gmail.com. So you can reach me that way. And thank you so much for asking. If you can take a moment to like my songs, I would really appreciate that.
Linda Williams, the physics chanteuse, on her new show, Atomic Cabaret. It will next be performed at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival starting on August 1st. The show is available for bookings, and Linda will curate material specific to an area's nuclear issues if you wish. I'll have links up to the show, her YouTube channel with all her songs, and her website on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 734. This has been Nuclear Hot Seat for Tuesday, July 21st, 2025. If you'd like to get Nuclear Hot Seat delivered via email every week, it's the easiest guaranteed way for you to get each week's episode as soon as it posts. Just go to nuclearhotseat.com, click on the yellow box, put in your first name and email address, and every week you will get one, just one email from us, which has a link to that week's show and a short description of its content. If you listen to a lot of podcasts, you can also sign up on your favorite podcast channel. That way, you never miss a single episode. Now, here's the audience participation pitch. If you have a story lead, a hot tip, or a suggestion of someone to interview, send that information in an email to info@nuclearhotseat.com. And remember, if you can go to Nuclear Hot Seat and donate, thank you, and know that whatever you can do to help does help. And we're deeply grateful that you listen and that you care. This episode of Nuclear Hot Seat is copyright 2025, Libby Halevi and Hartistry Communications. All rights reserved, but fair use allowed, as long as you cite the program, website, names of any guests whose comments you use, and me. We'll be going out this week on a song written and performed by Linda Williams for her show, Atomic Cabaret, Depleted Uranium. For now, this is Libby Halevi of Nuclear Hot Seat reminding you that as a statement by 21 Nobel Prize winners, faith healers, and experts reads, without clear and sustained efforts from world leaders to prevent nuclear war, there can be no doubt that our luck will finally run out. There you have it, your weekly nuclear wake-up call. So whatever you do, do not go back to sleep, because we are all in the nuclear hot seat.